Come to order. We want to thank people for their patience. I promised members that this will be our last committee hearing for the session. This committee has, the reason I say that is this committee has worked especially hard this session, meeting morning, noon, and night. In fact, I think we set the record this session for the number of hearings in one day. And so I really appreciate everything that the committee members have done in their attention to all the issues. We've talked about some significant issues this session, and we're still talking about them. But this is the last one for this session, and there's just so much we can do, and I think we did everything we possibly could. Even after deadlines, we were able to resolve a lot of issues. So the first item on the agenda is the confirmation of appointments to the Legislative Citizen Commission on Minnesota Resources. What we did yesterday is, because we had four people as well, or three people, we just had to maybe all four of you come up to the table. We'll go through some introductions, have some questions, and move on from there. And thank you for being here, and thank you for your patience in this confirmation process. But welcome, and maybe we can start, Mr. Berner, with you, and just introduce yourself, tell a little bit about your background, and why it's you'd like to be on the LCCMR.
Well, my name is Alfred Berner, and I moved to Minnesota in 1969 to take a position with the Department of Natural Resources, where I worked for 31 years in the area of farmland, wildlife populations, and research. And I had come from Michigan State, where I received my PhD in working on rough grouse habitat management. And through the years with the Department of Natural Resources and Wildlife, I had the opportunity to work with LCMR for a number of times in evaluating projects, even trying to put in for grants and so on, and have worked with the staff and have known John Lean for quite a number of years. And my interest, of course, is in furthering the, furthering, not just maintaining, the wildlife and natural resources of Minnesota. Of course, my expertise is in wildlife, and luckily we have other people that are real have backgrounds in water and forestry, and which gives it a really nice balance on the committee. And I'm looking forward to working at least a couple more years with LCCMR. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Good morning. My name is Nancy Gibson, and I have been chair of the Citizens Advisory Committee of the LCMR for 14 years. And before this step and this appointment. And so I've been through this process a couple times, but this time it's much more important. Right now we are sitting at the table and making some very important decisions about our state. And I'm thrilled to be in that position. I think this merger of citizens and legislators has been a good one. It's wonderful to have, when there are questions about issues, that you have some people at the table that can actually answer those questions. I have been active in wildlife, primarily wolves in the northern woods and up in the Arctic for over 20 years. I have worked with predators and prey and started the International Wolf Center. I have spent a lot of time in the field, not only in Minnesota, but around the world, and I see this as a wonderful opportunity to take advantage of some of these funds and invest them even farther into our state. I was very active in establishing the Environmental Trust Fund. I helped chair the reenactment of it in 1998 with Senator Jean Merriam. And in that, I was able, again, to travel the state and hear what people had to say, and was very interested in what people had to say. And I try to respond to those sort of things when we have our hearings. So I see this as a great opportunity. I will be appointed until 2008. So if you do appoint me, I will have one more year. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is John Hunt. I'm an environmental engineer by profession. I work for an environmental consulting firm that's based here in the Twin Cities. In addition to my professional background in the investigation and cleanup of soil and different types of groundwater contamination, I'm an avid hunter and angler and involved in a number of conservation organizations. The organization that I am most involved with at this time is the group Trout Unlimited. In that capacity, I'm the chair of the National Trout Unlimited's what they call Embrace a Stream Grant Committee, and on sort of a very much smaller version of LCCMR, I chair a group of volunteers from around the country that evaluate grant proposals for different types of resource, research, and education projects related to improving watershed health and water quality in watersheds that are predominantly related to trout and salmon populations. My experience thus far on the LCCMR has been very positive. I enjoyed working closely with my fellow citizens and getting to know some of the legislators and working with them to draft not only the request for proposals, but sort of the vision statements and some of those foundational documents that help guide the direction that we thought we wanted to direct funding this year. Very much enjoyed the opportunity to listen to these good ideas that applicants from around the state brought to us, and feel like the recommendations that we were able to craft and subsequently put before the legislature were very solid, and was pleased that they were passed. So I appreciate the opportunity to be here this morning. Thank you.
Thank you. And I should mention that Mr. Hunt rearranged a significant life event to be here today. So, some sort of real estate closing. Thank you. We appreciate it.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, Senators. My name is Mary Mueller, and I've applied for this position as someone who has spent all of my career basically working with landowners and on our own farm to apply conservation on the land. I'm a private business owner at this time, have been for about 10 years, working primarily with restoration work, both for wetland mitigation and for prairie restorations for the conservation programs. Prior to that, I spent about 15 years as a government employee for Soil and Water Conservation District and for the Board of Water and Soil Resources. And part of that time, I was actually funded by an LCMR grant. I spent 4 years on working as part of a research team studying the Minnesota River, and helped to develop a methodology to really look at how land use affects water quality. What I hope to bring to the committee is a voice of someone who's worked with landowners, as I say, and on our own land to try to grapple with the issues of how to get the conservation practices on the land that are really going to make a difference. And when I look at all the proposals that we bring in, having dealt with those kinds of projects in the past, I try to evaluate them as to whether or not they are really doable on the land and try to bring that voice into the discussions. I think it's been a great opportunity, and I really appreciate it. And I guess the last thing I'd like to say is I have also worked a lot with volunteer organizations that have worked to do restoration work on the land. And we've had to work in concert with government agencies and just bringing a bunch of clubs together to try to raise money. And it's been a really fun experience, and it's part of what I think I bring to this group as well. Thank you.
For the new members, it's important to reemphasize, because sometimes it gets lost in the debate. This is the LCCMR distributes money collected from the lottery as prescribed by our Constitution. Not all of the lottery proceeds go to the LCCMR. In fact, 60% of it goes to the general fund. But the part that does go to the LCCMR is distributed by a committee. But actually, this is the first year where we've actually had to confirm members of the LCCMR, because it always used to be legislators that were on this committee. And this is the first year where we have citizens. It was something that I actually advocated for a couple of years ago, and Dallas Sams picked up the flag, and finally last year we made this change, and this is the first time We're considering projects with the direct input and vote of citizens. I serve on the LCCMR, and I think it's been a good thing. I think it's been a very good thing. In fact, I don't know of any other commission or committee where you actually have tri-chairs. Oftentimes you have co-chairs, but now because we have a Senate, House, and citizens, each group has their own chair that they selected to maintain that balance. So, but I'm curious how do you folks think that this new structure has gone? Anyone can start.
I guess I'll start. And thank you, Mr. Chair, for your comments. I think, I'll be honest, in the beginning it was just a little edge there, but I think at the end we were a team. And I really felt welcomed by the senators and the House members, and I think that's evidenced by the product that we produced and that was passed. So I see it as a win-win situation, and I appreciate your efforts to make that. I think it's been a great model for our state. Thank you.
Mr. Berner.
In the words of my mother, it went a lot better than I expected. And she was a wise lady. I agree with Nancy. You know, when you go into something new, and I'm sure that legislators felt the same way, there was certain anxieties, but they worked out well, and I really enjoyed working with all the members. I learned a lot from all the different perspectives, and it's great to have that kind of balance. So.
One of the things I guess I had not anticipated was how much of the process we would need to get done before we could really get into the heart of the work of the commission. And so that was, I guess, for me personally, more challenging at the outset. But once we were able to get our request for proposal crafted and get it out for the public and begin having some of the, we called them hearings, but having some of the invited proposers come in and talk to us about what some of their ideas were. I mean, I think that's where I felt like the strength of the mixed group was coming together, and those of us that were representing a citizen's perspective with our varied backgrounds, I think we're able to bring some effective questions to the table and help broaden everyone's understanding. And so I'm looking forward to another opportunity to go through another cycle where a lot of that process now has been taken care of and behind us, and we can and focus more of our discussions on the crux of the natural resource issues.
And I'd like to say that I've always been kind of on the other side of working with these kinds of programs, and that is once there's a program in place, trying to implement it on the land. And to be on the front end part where the discussions are taking place on what kind of projects to fund was very interesting to me. It's a different perspective. I just feel that having the ability to have the voice of people who have worked in the field at the table with the senators to bring, as John said, some of these questions forward in the beginning is, this looks great, but how is it really going to work, and how are we going to get it so that it's deliverable? And I think this mixed voice of citizens and senators and representatives has been a really positive idea, and I'm really excited about it.
Mr. Chairman.
And I should mention that on Mr. Hunt's comments, normally the former LCMR had 2 years to have hearings and make proposals, and you know, we would pass those proposals every other year. Now we are considering proposals every year, but we didn't have this new commission until September. So the new group had only a few months to reconstitute itself, establish a process, hold hearings, debate, and make recommendations to the legislature all by January 15th. And so it was a remarkable process. Senator Pariseau.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just have to say that I feel that it's a great model, I believe, to pull all the salient parties together. But one of the, I like to give a lot of tribute of it to the staff. This is a team that has worked together for this group from the older style commission to the new one. And they are a team that are, they not only bring excellent skills, but they have a good relationship with each other and with the members of the board. And I believe that it's attributable to them that things went as smoothly as they did, because they bring great product to the table when the decisions are finally made, and help to hone the decision as they come through with experience that they've had in the past with similar questions or concerns that come to the table.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Vickerman.
Mr. Chair, I had the pleasure of chairing this committee before it got moved into the new committee, and I'm a co-chair with Representative Tingelstad and David Hartwell. And we can do great things. But I'm going to ask you members, we've had some bumps along the road with the staff, of the LCMR staff. I won't get into it any further than that, but if we're going to make this thing work, we have to all work together and respect each other. I might do some things that you don't like. Let me know about it. We need to work together because we got to have a good feeling. This operation and this program is going to work the way I hope it works, and I'm sure that's, Mr. Chairman, the way you hope it works. And so let's try to be tolerant of one another. Some of us have a different way of coming across with different things. Someday, if you want to, one-on-one, I will talk to you about it. I'm not going to get into that in this committee here today. So, Mr. Chair, if you don't need a lot more, and I know we got a schedule, I'd like to move confirmation of all four of these to the LCMR.
Okay. Further discussions? I think when you look at the resumes and backgrounds of these individuals, I think they certainly fit the criteria of not only people involved with conservation, but really they are have a strong background in the expertise, and they bring these they bring a not only a citizen's perspective, but a real industry, so to speak, expertise to the process, and I think that's probably what I found most valuable. I have one quick question. What do you feel are some of the emerging issues that the LCCMR will have to grapple with in the future years, either short-term or long-term?
I guess I can start with that. And this is in an agricultural part of the state perspective. We're seeing a big change in the demand for cropland, and it's going to impact our conservation programs in a big way, the ones, you know, that are outside of the purview of LCMR, like our CRP programs and RIM programs, those types of things. Land values are changing so fast. They're changing almost like gas prices. Mm-hmm. And I think it's going to be an emerging issue on how to balance this change in demand for agricultural crops and conservation. And we don't know where the ethanol debate's going to go at this point. I know you all have heard a lot about that this session.
Probably,
and I think it's just something that is really going to change how the agricultural part of the state deals with land issues. And I see that as an emerging issue that should be discussed on its environmental merits, and how we still work with agricultural producers to keep that conservation perspective as part of this change. Thank you.
Mr. Hunt.
I guess from my perspective, I would point to water quality in the future, both potential impacts from some of these changes in agricultural use or intensity of use, and the increased urbanization of our metro areas across the state. You know, finding the resources to be able to properly assess and plan for either the protection or the cleanup of our watersheds, so that we can continue to enjoy the multiple uses. Fishing, swimming, boating, all of those things that we all have come to enjoy, and just being able to have the resources available to work through that process across the entire state.
Ms. Gibson.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members, I think going farther north, our forests are changing very rapidly. And forest legacy is something that we need to really address. We obviously cannot afford to pay for all those forests, yet they are the ones that are capturing the carbons in our state. And we need to start looking at some natural solutions for global warming. The global warming debate has brought the environment to the forefront, and I appreciate all that. And now we need to take advantages of our prairies and our forests to make sure that they are part of the ingredients to keep the problems to a minimum. We're lucky in Minnesota. We have three ecoregions here. We're going to be affected more than other states, and I think we need to go into that with our eyes open.
Mr. Berner.
I guess since I've been here over 30-some years, and, of course, some of you have been here for your lifetime, what I see is, like every place elsewhere, loving our outdoors to death. We all want a piece of the pie, and the buffalo herd isn't going to last unless somehow you can work with development to maintain larger blocks of land that will maintain habitat coherence and still allow our participation by the populace with our resources out there. And one of the key areas are our lakes. We must realize that it's sort of an interesting thing is that lakeshore development is controlled by the counties, but it always seems like when they make bad decisions, the state has to come and clean it up. And I think local responsibility that we keep talking about means dollars, too, so they better start making better decisions instead of the states bailing them out all the time. So in addition to the other, it's going to be interesting on the global warming avenue is that we're going to see some species decline and others increase. We're already seeing that, and it's the wildlife is responding even more quickly than we are. They were subtle, and we didn't even realize it was going on, but they did. All the people that didn't believe they'd ever see a possum in the Twin Cities, that's global warming. And our moose herds are hurting because of global warming.
This weekend, we were driving along 394 entering Minneapolis, and on the freeway side in front of the noise barrier was a deer running along the freeway on 394 in front of the noise barrier. Said that deer is going to get killed. Later on, I went back to Minneapolis, and it was in the evening, and I exited on Broadway, and at the end of that off ramp was what I was pretty sure was the same deer.
Oh, jeez.
In North Minneapolis, running alongside, looking for some place to go. It was amazing.
Couldn't find the bus stop?
Couldn't find the bus stop, yeah. Senator Dill. And those are four different answers and four huge issues. And Mr. Berner, I appreciate you bringing up that local government issue, too.
Mr. Chair, members, I've reviewed the application here of these four individuals, and I would say they appear to be absolutely outstanding, and I'm very happy they're willing to serve, and I think we should enthusiastically endorse them.
Further discussion? If none, Senator Vickerman has moved to send the appointments to the LCCMR of Alfred Berner, Nancy Gibson, John Hunt, and Mary Mueller to the floor with the recommendation that they be confirmed. Further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you. The next item on the agenda is the Pollution Control Agency's presentation of a 3M water agreement, also known as the consent order. We'll just give a moment for the previous witnesses to clear.
Yeah.
did that come from? Members, we have a summary of the issue passed out that it was created by the PCA. We appreciate this document. It is, I think it's really good that you presented this on paper of just the proposed consent orders. So that was very good as well. So thank you for being here. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Leo Dodice, and I'm the Deputy Commissioner of the MPCA. And I really appreciate the opportunity to come here today to talk about the proposed consent order so we can try to explain what it contains and maybe talk a little bit about the process of how we got to the proposed order. If I may, I thought I would just provide a little bit of background for the committee because not all members are as familiar as perhaps others might be with the history of these sites and sort of how we got to the board last month. So if I may do that.
Certainly. And also, by way of background, members, this relates to the hearing we had earlier this session on Senator Sieben's bill regarding the designation of PFCs as a hazardous substance. If you recall, we had a discussion. Senator Sieben withdrew her bill from consideration from committee, or for the purposes of that hearing, the bill still is in this committee. But that was what my understanding was, pursuant to the some other activities that went on that Mr. Rodice, how do I pronounce it correctly?
Rodice
will describe now.
Thank you. Well, just a little bit of background. The 3M Corporation produced a class of compounds over several decades back in the previous century that were subsequently disposed of in several sites around the metropolitan area. And even though these wastes were legally disposed of at the time, like many industrial wastes that were disposed of historically, they're not currently disposed of in a way that would meet current standards. So consequently, these compounds are getting into the environment, they've got into the environment, and they're causing a series of problems as a result. And these problems are both in terms of environmental contamination and human health concerns. So the agency got involved several years ago in trying to address this problem. And I guess I'll just bring you up to date on what the recent activity has been. There has been concern at the agency that we need to have a more formal framework for dealing with this contamination so that we really can provide assurances to the community and to ourselves that we really are addressing this problem in as thorough a manner as possible. Toward that end, the commissioner decided to move this issue forward based on a couple of principles that I think you're seeing played out today. One is that we wanted to make sure that whatever we did was very, very open, transparent, and public. So we wanted to make sure that we took advantage of all the public processes that are available to us to make sure that we have a good, healthy discussion about this issue and to make sure that everybody at least knows what's happening so that folks are fully informed and have access to the process. And I think we've done that. The other thing that the commissioner is very, very interested in is that we have a rock-solid legal framework for moving forward well into the future. The commissioner understands that this issue is probably going to be before us for a number of years and probably well beyond his term as commissioner. I mean, he wanted to make sure that future commissioners had all the appropriate legal tools at their disposal to continue to deal with this in a responsible manner. And I think we're moving forward in that direction as well. Last month in April, the commissioner moved a recommendation to the MPCA Citizens Board to take formal action under the state's MRLA statute, and that's the Minnesota Environmental Response and Liability Act. And what he proposed to the board back in April was that we essentially move forward under the standard process known as a RFRA process. And I'm going to use this term repeatedly throughout my presentation, so I'll just define it here at the outset. But RFRA refers to Response for Request Action. What that actually is it's essentially an administrative step that the agency can take to clean up specific sites of concern under the MRLA statute. There are three specific sites.
And the MRLA statute is?
The MRLA statute, I don't have the specific citation in front of me, but it's the Minnesota Environmental Response and Liability Act.
Minnesota Environmental Response and Liability Act.
Yes.
And that's where we define hazardous substances and the process for cleaning them up?
Correct.
Generally speaking?
Correct.
Okay, very good. So RFRA and MRLA.
Correct. The action that we brought before the board last April was to issue a RFRA, this request for response action, for each of three sites that have these problematic wastes in them. And we essentially made a presentation to the board, explained why we thought this is the appropriate action to take. Through that action, a number of things would happen. One is that the agency would, in effect, declare these compounds as hazardous substances and would direct 3M to take appropriate actions to essentially clean up the sites. There was a pretty vigorous discussion at the board last April, and what the board directed the staff to do was to go back and try to negotiate a consent agreement with the 3M company to try to address these issues. And we have historically, under the MRLA statute, cleaned up sites in one of two different ways. We either enter into RFRAs with the company or we do consent orders. So it's a time-tested and legally sound method for dealing with these sorts of issues. And the board is aware of that because they have approved consent orders in the past under the MRLA statute. So they directed us to go back and to try to negotiate an agreement with the company. And they gave us seven specific things that they wanted us to focus on. And the consent order that we have negotiated with the company and that we are bringing back before the board this coming Tuesday, we think, addresses those concerns thoroughly. And, in fact, we think it actually goes beyond what the board requested us to do. We think we have a stronger position on this issue than we did with the RFRAs that we presented to the board last month. So what I'd like to do is just walk through those seven points very briefly. They're in the briefing materials that you have before you. And the reason I want to hone in on those seven points is because that was the direction that was given to us by the board, and it's what guided us in the negotiation process. A little bit about the process before I describe the seven items. We had four members on the PCA's negotiating team. We had the Remediation Division Director, Kathy Sather, myself, Carla Heil, Assistant Attorney General, as well as Alan Williams, Assistant Attorney General. The last person was extremely key to the discussions because Alan Williams, as many of you may know, has been involved with the MRLA statute for many, many years, and is probably, I would say, the state's leading expert on the implementation of that statute. So what I'll do now is I'll walk through the seven items very briefly, and then we'd be happy to take any questions that you may have as a result of my presentation. The first item that was very important to the Citizens Board is that any consent order that we would negotiate with 3M would contain a rigorous and robust cleanup plan. Now, the board talked a little bit about what that meant to them. They did not provide, they do not have a unanimous voice in terms of what that means. One board member believed that all the material ought to be excavated. Other board members thought it ought to be left up to the staff, and there were others that were perhaps somewhere in between. What we ended up negotiating in this proposed consent order is actually a cleanup standard that goes quite a bit beyond what we typically would do under the MRLA statute. What the proposed agreement calls for is that the problematic materials would be essentially excavated and disposed of in an appropriate manner so they wouldn't continue to get out into the environment. This is an option that we may have been able to pursue under a RFRA. But I suspect that that entailed some legal risks as the if the agency wanted to pursue something as stringent as excavation of these materials, the 3M company would be able to challenge that in court, and there was a risk of litigation. So we think that this is actually a positive step forward because the proposed consent order does call for a more enhanced remediation standard, which we think is pretty robust and is not subject to litigation. The other thing that the agreement does call for, and it's not laid out specifically in the consent order, is that there's been concern about sediments in the river, both in the cove that is right adjacent to the site, but also sediments in the river itself. And we consider those sediments that are adjacent to the site part of the site. And 3M is currently investigating the sediments in the river, and any appropriate remediation that needs to take place, including excavation, will take place under this order. The second item that was very important to the board, and it was very, very important to the commissioner as well, was that the proposed consent order recognized the agency's jurisdiction. In other words, that it's jurisdictionally sound. The reason this is important to the agency and to the board is if we enter into some sort of a disagreement over execution of this and implementation of this agreement, we need to be able to go to a judge and say that our jurisdiction is recognized under this agreement and that we can bring an action to the court under the MERLA statute. We have done that in this proposed agreement. The way the proposed agreement deals with this is typical to any settlement agreement that the agency enters into is we recognize that there's a dispute with the regulated party on the issue of the statutory citation. But in the end, the agreement, both parties agree in the agreement that this this agreement is enforceable under the MERLA statute. So again, if we enter into any kind of a dispute at a later date and we need to go to court, it would be enforceable under that MERLA statute.
Mr. Rodiz, what would be enforceable under the MERLA statute?
Mr. Chair, anything that's required under this order would be enforceable under the MERLA statute. So if there's a dispute about the cleanup, if there's a dispute about whether cost reimbursement that we've requested is, in the other party's opinion, inappropriate, that's something that could be brought to the court. Essentially, anything under this order that was subject to a dispute could end up in a court proceeding, potentially. We don't expect that to happen, but there's always that potential.
Thank you. Continue.
The third issue that the board wanted to see addressed was that municipal and private drinking water supplies are addressed. We again think that we've done this. There have been, in our view, informal agreements that the 3M company has had with the communities to deal with the drinking water issues for two of the compounds in particular. Those two compounds are PFOS and PFOA. There is also a third compound that we recently were finding in the environment last year, which is called PFBA, and for which a health standard does not currently exist. But for the first two compounds, the 3M company has voluntarily agreed to clean up the drinking water in communities that have levels of those compounds that are, in their view, unacceptable. What this agreement does is it locks it down as a legal requirement moving forward so that if there is, again, any kind of a dispute as to whether continued treatment or provision of alternative drinking water is in question, simply that question has been removed, and that's formally a part of this agreement. The other thing that this agreement does is that for this compound PFBA, which the health department is currently developing a drinking water standard for, is that once that standard is issued, and we expect that to happen sometime within about a year, that once that standard is issued, if there are any exceedances of that standard in drinking water related to these sites, they are required under this agreement to provide alternative drinking water to those communities. Again, the company has had commitments that they've made to the local communities to do that, but we wanted to make sure that we had that locked down in a formal legal agreement with the state, and that's what this proposed consent order does. The fourth action is that the board wanted to make sure that we addressed any future action on PFBAs. You know, I think on this particular item, we've done something that goes quite a bit beyond what we were able to get through the RFRAs, and I'll describe that as best I can. First of all, I talked about the drinking water issue. It's clear in the agreement that if we do have an exceedance of a future health-based standard for PFBA, that 3M is required to take care of that, take care of the residents, and make sure that the drinking water is safe. The second thing that this proposed consent order does is it essentially provides for essentially immediate remediation of PFBA contamination along with all the other PFCs that are currently in the ground. Under the RFRAs that we had proposed for the board, what we told the board is that we were setting the stage for some future remediation of PFBA. We did not feel we had sufficient information at that time to be able to create RFRAs for PFBA. We told the board that we expect that we would probably at some later date come back and ask to take additional action to remediate that. The difference with this agreement is that basically we have agreed with 3M to start doing that right now. So it gets that ball moving much more quicker than we would have through the RFRA process. The fifth item that the board was interested in was that we address any additional studies on the health and environmental effects of PFCs in the environment. We've done this in two ways in the proposed agreement, and I'm going to try to draw a distinction between these two ways as much as I can because they're very, very key. The first way in which the proposed order deals with this issue is that in the agreement, if there are any studies that the state needs to undertake to investigate the presence or effects of PFCs in the environment that's related to the three sites in question. And these three sites, by the way, are the Cottage Grove Chemo Light facility, there's a disposal site in Woodbury, and there's also a disposal site in Oakdale. If there's any study that the state needs to do to investigate the presence or effects of PFCs in the environment related to these sites, those costs are fully reimbursable under this agreement. And the decisions on what studies need to be undertaken to do this investigation is up to the PCA, and again, those are fully reimbursable costs. There are other environmental studies that the state has an interest in doing and is currently undertaking that is not directly related to these sites. A perfect example is the bluegill contamination that we've discovered in Lake Calhoun in Minneapolis. Our staff really cannot currently see any kind of a connection to these three sites. Yet these are issues of great importance to the community, and it's a significant issue for the agency. What we've negotiated in this agreement is that outside of the work that would be related to the sites, 3M has committed over a period of 4 years to provide up to $5 million to the state to do studies that we think are necessary to really look into the presence and effects of PFCs in the environment in general. These studies will be undertaken at the state's entire discretion. The agreement calls for us to consult with 3M on those studies, but the decisions on what we do and the scope of what we do is entirely at the PCA's discretion. This $5 million in funding for the additional work was something we simply couldn't have gotten through the RFRA process. So we think that was a significant aspect of the deal for the citizens of the state. The sixth issue was that the board wanted to see that the agreement addressed the need for continued cooperation from 3M on sharing information and research. There are two things in the proposed agreement that deal with this issue. The first is that we have a very specific commitment from 3M to complete what's known as the 90-day study on PFBAs. This is a study that's very key for the Department of Health for them to be able to set their health-based limit for drinking water. So there's a commitment in the agreement for 3M to complete the study and to provide those results to the state as soon as they are ready. The second thing that we agree to is that there's a firm commitment in this proposed order that 3M will provide the state with access to any non-privileged documents. And when I mean non-privileged, I mean those that are not subject to attorney-client privilege. So they would provide us access to any documents related to PFCs that we feel we need to be able to do a thorough investigation into the nature of this problem. The last item that the board wanted us to ensure was addressed, and it's again very key both to the board and to the commissioner, is that the proposed order preserves the agency's right to take any additional action in the future it deems necessary. I'd say that the agreement probably does that in two very important ways. One is if there's information that we feel we should have known at the time that the agreement was signed, but we didn't know, we can go back and take additional action to address whatever those issues might be. The second and probably broadest aspect of this aspect of the agreement is that if for any reason the agency believes that the environment and public health is not protected as a result of this agreement, we can go back and do what's necessary to address that concern. So I think that's a pretty key aspect of this agreement. And for the commissioner, he believes that this preserves the right of future commissioners to make sure that appropriate action is taken in the event we discover something that we weren't aware of at the time of this agreement. Two final things to mention, and these were things that were very important to the commissioner but were not actually raised as specific items of interest by the Citizens Board. One has to do with Washington County Landfill. There is a landfill in Washington County that is currently owned by the state, and it's managed through the state's closed landfill program. Under this program, all liability for cleanup of that site has been assumed by the state. What we negotiated through this proposed agreement is that 3M would provide up to $8 million to contribute to the cost of remediating the site. It's important that we get these dollars because we expect that the cost to clean up the site, which does contain some PFCs that were disposed of by 3M in the past, it could be quite expensive. We're not sure what the total cost will be, but under the RFRA scenario, we would have recovered zero additional costs, and we think that this is a good win for the taxpayers, and that we'll get $8 million that we would not otherwise have been able to get to help clean up the site. The last thing is that there is a specific mention in the agreement about the state preserving its ability to go back and pursue any natural resource damage assessment claims against the company as a result of any damages that we feel have been incurred by the environment. Typically, the way this works is the state can try to arrive at a dollar figure associated with any damage to the natural resource, whether it's the fishing resource or something else, and then try to negotiate a settlement with the company to essentially recover those costs. So that's pretty specifically laid out in the agreement. That's it in a nutshell. Where we stand right now is, as I mentioned, this matter is pending before the Citizens Board. The board is scheduled to meet on Tuesday of next week, where it will take up this matter, and the staff will recommend to the Citizens Board that they do authorize the commissioner to sign this agreement and move forward with the remediation as described in the agreement.
Thank you, Mr. Rodis. Just general question, what is not in the agreement? What has the state given up? What has 3M given up so that we've reached this compromise?
Mr. Chair, what the 3M company, and they can certainly speak to this better than I can because this is their issue, the 3M company was very concerned, and they were very specific about this concern at the board meeting last month, that they did not want to see the RFRA move forward because that would result in a formal declaration of PFCs as hazardous substances under MRLA. So that was a concern that they expressed. Going back to what I said at the beginning of my presentation, the way we dealt with that issue is that while they reserve the right to continue to contest that these are hazardous substances, the important thing from the agency's perspective is that we have the authority under MRLA where we believe we do have the evidence to show that these meet all the tests of MRLA, including that they're hazardous substances. But we continue to dispute that. But for the implementation of this agreement and for the purpose of remediating these sites, that both parties acknowledge that MRLA does apply. So I think that's the key thing. From our perspective, that's not a loss because we have all the legal jurisdiction we need to do the cleanup under MRLA, and that was the important thing for the agency all along.
And I thought I was picking that up from the consent order as well. But then on page 18, it talks about MPCA will not consider any excavated material from the sites to be hazardous waste. So how does that reconcile with what you just said about retaining jurisdiction under MRLA?
Mr. Chair, what that's referring to is hazardous waste as defined under the federal RCRA law. And this is actually one of the issues that was raised at the board meeting last month, is that 3M's contention is that there is confusion about what is and what is not a hazardous waste if this declaration were made under MRLA. There are different laws that deal with hazardous waste, different definitions of hazardous waste, and some substances that are considered hazardous waste and treated as such under the Federal Resource Conservation Recovery Act. What we're trying to get at in this part of the agreement is that anybody who's reading this agreement should not interpret this to mean that these are now deemed to be hazardous wastes as regulated by the RCRA statute. And that's important because in a typical Superfund remediation, we're dealing with compounds that need to be properly disposed of. And you need to make sure that you can do that in an expeditious manner possible. What we wanted to make sure is that there wasn't any confusion at all, that through this action, we would consider these compounds to be regulated under the RCRA statute so that they could be disposed of in an expeditious and proper manner.
It does say Minnesota or federal law or regulations. Do we need to specifically reference RCRA under this to be more consistent with what you just said?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I don't believe we do. We could always ask Carl Heil, the Assistant Attorney General, to clarify that. But we do have also state hazardous waste laws that follow the federal RCRA law, so I could have been a little more clear on that. essentially, what we wanted to make sure is that through this agreement that we weren't sending the message that these were to be regulated under the hazardous waste statutes.
I have a few more questions, but Senator Sieben, do you have a follow-up on this?
Well, just on that subject, Mr. Odies, didn't the board, the PCA board, expressly direct the agency to recognize the state's MRLA authority to regulate these as hazardous substances? Wasn't that one of the directions of the board?
Mr. Chair, Senator, what the board wanted us to do is to make sure that the agreement recognized the agency's jurisdiction to do the cleanups. And our understanding of that is that as long as we are able to do this cleanup under this agreement, under the MRLA statute, which this agreement does, if that would satisfy the board's direction.
And Mr. Chair, then, Mr. Odies, explain to me again why we need, or perhaps counsel could explain why on page 18 it says, for purposes of implementation of this agreement, the MBCA agrees that will not consider any excavated material from the sites to be hazardous waste under Minnesota or federal law. And it goes on. I guess I'm not following your argument then.
Mr. Rodis.
Mr. Chair, Senator, again, as I mentioned, there are hazardous wastes that are regulated under different statutes. Typically, compounds that are regulated under those statutes are regulated by rule. And we wanted to, again, make it abundantly clear that through this agreement, we were not saying that these needed to be regulated as hazardous wastes.
Under Minnesota law?
Under Minnesota and state law, correct. Or in federal law, excuse me.
Ms. Baker.
Oh, Mr. Chair, I think when I'm reading between the lines on your question, does that mean the way you clean up and dispose of them is different? Does that sentence mean that you don't have to follow federal laws in disposing of a hazardous waste? And does this make it easier to clean up? Or just, we understand that you don't want to call it a hazardous waste, but is the cleanup or disposal any different because of this sentence?
The short answer to that, Mr. Chair, is no, but I'll have Alan Williams perhaps address the legal questions that are being raised, as he's probably in a better position to provide you a specific, accurate answer.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Alan Williams, Assistant Attorney General. Let me try to address a couple of the questions that have been asked here. First of all, there is a separate definition of hazardous waste in the MRLA statute, which the board had been advised that they could invoke in order to issue the request for response actions if they chose to do so. If they invoked that particular definition of hazardous waste in MRLA, that would not have resulted in PFCs becoming regulated hazardous wastes for purposes of treatment, storage, and disposal, the kinds of things that appear in PCA's hazardous waste regulations, because that's a separate question from remediation. This particular provision in the consent order is very narrowly worded, and I would point out the narrowing is at the end of the sentence where it says that these would not be considered hazardous waste solely by virtue of the presence of PFCs in the material. And that's important because if there's any other reason why this material, when excavated, could be a hazardous waste, such as it could be very acidic or corrosive, it could potentially, if concentrations are high enough, it could trigger some other characteristics that would make it a hazardous waste and would require hazardous waste regulations to kick in. All of that remains possible. The only thing that this language limits the agency with respect to is that the agency would not consider this to be hazardous waste for regulatory purposes solely because there's PFCs in it.
As opposed to
if there are enough PFCs, if there's a concentration of PFCs that would make it lethal to lab animals, for example, it would still be a hazardous waste and would have to be treated as such. or if it's corrosive, it would have to be treated as such.
Could it be argued later on at any time that the PCA has agreed that PFCs are not hazardous materials by the sentence?
Mr. Chair, this is not in any way contradictory to the recommendation that was made to the PCA board with respect to whether PFCs are hazardous waste under MRLA. Doesn't affect that.
So this is not an admission that on the part of PCA that the excavated material is a hazardous waste under MRLA?
Mr. Chair, no. It has nothing to do with whether these would be hazardous substances under MRLA or hazardous waste under MRLA.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Mr. Rodiz, how long is this agreement in effect?
Mr. Chair, there is no end date to the agreement. There are certain provisions of the agreement that have end dates. For example, the dollars that are going to be provided for research have a four-year lifespan, essentially, and there's an opportunity for us to revisit that. But essentially, this just deals with the cleanup no matter what it takes. So it's an open-ended agreement.
I thought you were very reasonable.
Given that it's an open-ended agreement, can a RFRA still be ordered in the future?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, if we feel that that's a necessary step to take, yes, that was very key, that we preserve the right to take additional action in the future if we think it's necessary.
And a more specific question on the discussion of how the excavated material will be stored. The term vault was used. What does that mean?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'll try to describe the options that the company has as best as I can, and they will be fully fleshed out as we work through the details, as the company works through their feasibility studies. But the agreement basically gives them several different options. One is they can take these materials and they can transport them off-site to some hazardous waste disposal facility. In other words, some facility that's good, and that's basically the kind of facility you need to use to ensure that it doesn't get back into the environment. The other option the company has is to construct that kind of a facility on site. And when we say vault, essentially it means it's a lined facility that essentially ensures that the material that's placed in that facility does not get back into the environment. The problem we have today is that these materials have been placed in sites that are not lined. So they just consequently they keep getting into the soil and into the groundwater. So a vault is essentially, it's basically a layperson's term for it, just a secured, lined, underground facility. The company also does have the option of considering the waste if they think that that's a better option to pursue. That's something we would consider if they decided they wanted to do that. The agreement also calls for a public hearing to be held on these options so that the public will have an opportunity to provide input on whatever ultimate decision is decided upon.
Senator Anderson.
Mr. Chair, on this point, now I'm trying to go back to what you were saying a minute ago about the hazardous waste designation. So, and I'm just looking at the summary here that says, and I think as you just testified, that it would be stored like a hazardous waste would be stored, that it would be, it says that in this document, under the proposed consent order, waste that is removed will be permanently controlled either through containment an underground line vault that meets all hazardous waste disposal standards or by incineration. And so I guess what the question that raises is, are we saying that they don't have to meet hazardous waste standards for disposal, but you're assuming that it will, but I think this document specifically says they don't have to. So, for example, if they didn't do a very good job of that, assuming the worst, of course, which is the base, you know, the assumption mm-hmm. of the question. What if something goes wrong is the basis of our questions, of course. If they didn't really meet hazardous waste standards in disposing of it, this document would preclude any liability for that. It seems to me, under the sentence that we were talking about earlier. Am I wrong?
Mr. Rodiz?
Well, Mr. Chair, Member, Senator, I'll just reflect upon the discussions in the negotiation. It's very clear to the parties involved that what we're looking at is the kind of disposal that's typically done and has been historically done at Superfund sites. Generally, what that means is if you take a material out of the ground and you put it someplace secure, you're generally putting it in a facility that meets the same standards as if it were a hazardous waste landfill. Doesn't mean it's permitted as a hazardous waste landfill, but it meets those standards. And that's important because that's the maximum amount of protection you can provide for the material. Our objective is not to create some unnecessary regulatory maze. Our objective is to make sure that there is a technically sound way of making sure these materials are disposed of properly, they're not going to get back in the environment, and that we have every assurance necessary to make sure that's going to happen and that the public has input in that decision.
Well, Mr. Chair, Mr. Rodis, I guess I'm wondering what the kind of the assurance is for the public that storage will be to those highest level of standards. I mean, it seems like we're specifically saying there's no legal assurance of that here, so we're counting on the agency to do it, but there's no backup. I mean, is there anything that commits that to happen, that it will be stored in a safe way and transported? I don't know. Maybe it's in here because I apologize. I haven't read this very carefully. I've just read parts of it. I just haven't had time.
Are we moving this stuff simply from one dump to another?
Mr. Chair, members, that is not at all the intention of the agreement. And as the studies come forward, the language, the technical language in the exhibits points us in a pretty specific direction in terms of what's expected. And that's to make sure that this problem is permanently taken care of. Historically, again, the way we've dealt with this in the remediation program under the MRLA statute is to do it in the way that I described. That facility, should it be constructed, would have to have a permit from the agency that would specifically say what conditions are attached to that permit so that everybody can understand how it's regulated. You know, this is splitting hairs legally a little bit, but you don't have to have a hazardous waste permit to have something meet hazardous waste disposal standards. There are other ways of doing that. What the MRLA statute envisions is that you clean up the problem and you do so as quickly as possible and in the most appropriate manner possible. We've done this in a number of different cases before of MRLA cleanups. This would be no different. This would be a very regulated process, and again, the public would be involved in the decision.
Mr. Chair.
Sarah Sieben.
Just to follow up to that then, and I'm sorry to be repetitive here, but will the cleanup of all the three sites meet hazardous waste definitions? Because my understanding of the agreement was for the purpose of this agreement, 3M doesn't agree they're hazardous waste. The agency still reserves their right to contend that they are. But for purposes of this agreement, the wastes are going to be transported and dealt with in a manner as though they were hazardous waste. And I just want to be very clear that is the intention and that's what it says in this document.
Mr. Rodis.
Mr. Chair, and I apologize, but I'm not quite sure I understand the question.
I think the senator is trying to seek clarification that although these are not being deemed hazardous wastes, will they, for all intents and purposes, be treated as hazardous waste for the purposes of excavation, transport, and storage?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee,
I think... Is that correct, Senator?
Right, sure. Exactly. Because it's my understanding that there's very different guidelines in state and federal statutes for how you clean up either just, you know, regular waste that would be cleaned up or hazardous waste. And I just want to have some reassurances here that it's going to be treated as hazardous waste for the purposes of the cleanup of the three sites.
Mr. Chair,
Mr. Williams approaching.
Thank you.
Mr. Williams.
Mr. Chair, I'll try to answer Senator Sieben's question if I can. Because this consent order is issued pursuant to MRLA and because the key provisions dealing with the cleanup of the three sites are handled pursuant to MRLA, the standards for cleanup will be the standards pursuant to MRLA. So to that extent, yes, these are going to be treated as though they were hazardous substances under MRLA.
Okay.
Thank Thank you.
What is 3M's total dollar commitment under this consent order? That is laid out in actual dollar amounts, excluding potential future commitments.
Mr. Chair, members, the total dollar figures that are known in this agreement is roughly $13.6 million. All that represents is are three different elements of the agreement. The first is the $8 million commitment to help defray the costs of the remediation of Washington County landfill. There's $5 million for the additional research into the investigation of the presence and effects of PFCs in the environment, so that's 13. And there's also a reimbursement amount that's just about $600,000 for past work that the agency has done to investigate PFCs, their presence and effects in the environment. And a lot of that has to do with the development of water quality standards for PFCs. So those are called out specifically. As far as the total dollar amount of this order, we're not in a position to say precisely what that's going to be, simply because the cost reimbursement provisions related to our work on the sites is open-ended. It depends on what work needs to be done, in our opinion. The other thing that's not known for certain is exactly how expensive this cleanup will be. The cleanup that this order describes is quite a bit more than what's typically done under the MRLA statute. So our expectation is it's going to be some amount more expensive than it would be under normal circumstances. How much more expensive, we won't know until it's done.
Senator Sieben.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Rodes, could you explain what the intent is for the designation of drinking water versus just treatment or remediation of residential water supplies? And I'll give you where my line of thinking is coming here. It seems to me that the remediation, for instance, and I'm especially concerned about PFBA, of course, because, for instance, in some parts of Lower Cottage Grove and Great Cloud Island, private drinking wells have exceeded 5 parts per billion. Currently, there's the Department of Health issued a health advisory level, which is not a health-based value, so it's just sort of their best guess of what would be considered safe, of 1 part per billion. So it's significantly above that. So these people are on private wells. And it seems to me, under reading this, 3M agrees that if a health-based value is exceeded, so say it is for some of these private wells at a later date that's determined, then the company is required to provide drinking water. And I'm curious why the word drinking water was included instead of residential water, for instance, because it would seem to me that if I grew up on a private well, for instance, in Newport, if I can't imagine that it would be that easy for people to always have to have bottled water. It would seem as though they would want in-house filter placed on their well so that all of their residential water would be below the values that the Department of Health considers to be safe. Could you comment on that, and please?
Mr. Rodes.
Mr. Chair, Senators, Senator Sieben, the reason we're focusing on drinking water is because if there is a health-based value issue for PFBA, for example, the issue is its consumption. It's not contact. And I would have to defer the Department of Health to get into this, the reason specifically why they do that way. But what we're concerned about here is if there is a value related to consumption, that problem be addressed. And should we encounter that situation, when the HBV is issued for PFBA, which I expect the health department to do, and we do have exceedances, then we'll make sure that this agreement is implemented as it's envisioned, which is that people that are affected by that really have access to drinking water that is below those levels. Beyond that, I think if we were to deal with something other than consumption, I think that would go beyond what the health-based value would be pointing toward.
Well, Mr. Chair, which I understand, and maybe that's practical, and it would seem to me that in terms of what would be reasonable costs, in some of these cases, it wouldn't be very feasible to provide bottled water for an indefinite period of time until the levels are cleaned up anyway. But I'll certainly follow up with the Department of Health on that issue, too, because I know that people are concerned, have raised concerns about washing their vegetables in, you know, mm-hmm. how else they consume water through bathing and other sources. So that's one.
Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Odese, I think I like what's in here as far as the cleaning up of the ground contamination at these sites. I think it looks like it's pretty comprehensive. But my concern is to try to understand the impact on the water. And I, as far as I can see, there's not really any plan in here that deals with cleaning the water. Is there? I mean, is it possible to remove these substances from water, whether it's in the Mississippi River, in a well, in groundwater, wherever it occurs? Is it possible to remove the substance, these PFCs and related substances from water?
Mr. Robbins.
That? Mr. Chair, members, you know, I think that's a question that we face on any Superfund cleanup, that once it's released and it's in the groundwater at large, what do you do about that, and can you get that genie back in the bottle? And I think in most cases that's just technically not feasible. What we do under these MRLA cleanups is to do everything we can to address the releases that are coming off of the sites and make sure that that doesn't continue to happen. And to the extent that we have contamination that's not safe or is not acceptable by Department of Health standards, that we deal with that precisely. Unfortunately, sometimes once these compounds are in the environment, they're going to be there until they're gone. And so I think the simple answer to your question is that no matter what agreement we reach, that's a question that we probably would have difficulty answering. The one thing I can say is that when I look at this consent order, and this was very key to me as we were having the negotiations, is I wanted to be sure that whatever we had was at least as strong, if not stronger, than what we would have gotten under the RFRA process. And on issues such as surface water, drinking water, groundwater, I do believe that we have this proposed order is quite superior to the RFRA, simply because I think we're going to have many more tools at our disposal to investigate the surface water issues, to really understand the extent of the contamination of the groundwater. And then if we do have exceedances, as Senator Sieben had described, that we have a formal framework in place to make sure that the residents are protected. And for us, that's key, and it's more than we could have gotten out of the RFRA process, quite frankly.
Well, Mr. Chair, Mr. Rodese, so the framework that is in place to protect is that there will be bottled water provided for residents. Is that what you're referring to?
Mr. Rodese.
Mr. Chair, Senators, again, as Senator Sieben discussed, I mean, I think the challenge of how you do that, depending on the specific circumstances, I mean, you don't know what you're going to have until you get to that point. So depending on what an individual resident or a community is facing, you decide on what the appropriate remedy is. It'd be too speculative to say exactly what we would do, because we don't know what that situation would be.
You know, Mr. Chair, I don't understand our environmental laws as well as I would like to, and in the state of Minnesota. And so I guess I just wonder if there's any way to hold accountable a company that has put pollutants into our waters permanently, or essentially permanently. And it sounds like you're saying there really isn't, beyond trying to provide an alternative for people to drink for some period of time. I guess, well, that's not really a question. I'm just
I could ask a question based on that, Senator Anderson. Maybe Mr. Williams could answer. We have remedies in statute for cleanup of the land. Do we have any remedies for cleanup of the water?
Mr. Chair, Alan Williams from the Attorney General's Office. The MRLA statute provides authority to clean up releases to the environment generally. That would include surface water, groundwater, land, wherever the releases are. I think one of the things that's been overlooked in the conversation here is that there is the alternative of pumping groundwater and treating groundwater and removing PFCs and other types of contaminants from that groundwater, and that actually is being done at some of these sites, or can be done at these sites. So that aspect is there as well. One other possibility would be the natural resource damages liability that a party has for releasing contaminants into the environment. So potentially, if there's groundwater contamination that can't be cleaned up because it's not feasible, because there's no technically feasible way to do that, but that groundwater is now unavailable for its normal use, I think you could make an argument that that's a natural resource damage. And this consent order doesn't limit the PCA from attempting to recover for natural resource damages.
Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, then I want to follow up with that by looking at the section of the agreement about the covenant not to sue, and just make sure I understand what this covers, because it goes again to that issue of water. What I'm on page 39, it talks about, let's see, I think what this is saying is that the MPCA agrees not to go after 3M for any action to address any discharge, release, or threatened release of PFCs at or from the sites known to the MPCA on the date of the agreement. So what I want to know is, I mean, it's, we know what at the three sites is, but question would be, what does from the sites mean? And so if there's leakage, if leakage has already occurred from those sites into groundwater, but we don't know about it yet, where would that fall? Even if the site is known, does that include leakage from the site that's known, even if the contamination that's occurred from that site is not known?
Mr. Chair, Senator Anderson, I'm not sure I completely understand your question. The one of the ways that MRLA works is that it requires the responsible party to thoroughly investigate the releases. Okay. So it's very possible that in those kinds of investigations could result in discovering more than what we know today with respect to the releases that are out there at these three sites. We could find out that there's more extensive contamination potentially than what we know today. That would be covered by the order. In other words, the company would be required to address that. If there's something that the investigations under this order don't turn up, but it turns up later, then that's a reopener issue.
Well, Mr. Chair, let me make sure I understand that. Okay. And I don't know, maybe a basic fact that I don't understand is that the contamination that you've already found in the drinking water is already connected to these sites. Is that accurate, that we already know that's where it's coming from these sites, in the private wells or wherever else you found it? Okay, maybe that's a separate issue.
Yeah.
That's a bigger – let's ask that later. Okay, so you just said that if it's leakage, if during the investigation and remediation of these sites, if they find that there's been leakage into the groundwater, that would be covered by the remediation requirements. I think I heard you say that. But if there's some future contamination that goes beyond that, it wouldn't be? What would that?
No, Mr. Chair, Senator Anderson, no. What I was indicating was, you know, the investigations under this order will be as thorough as the agency can make them. Mm-hmm. But if for some reason those investigations don't turn up some water contamination that shows up later, that could still be dealt with by the agency.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Williams, if it's connected to one of these three sites?
Mr. Williams.
Or not.
Mr. Chair, Senator Anderson, the cleanup that's being pursued under the MRLA authority is the cleanup at these three sites.
So, Mr. Chair, Mr. Williams,
and from these three sites.
So, if it goes beyond that, you're saying you would still have the authority to.
That would be outside of the order, and the authority would be there to take action with respect to that.
Okay. And so, what about the Mississippi River? What about contamination in the Mississippi River? And you mentioned before something about the sediments, and I know there was dumping right into the Mississippi. So, is that considered part of one of these sites?
contamination in the Mississippi River.
Mr. Chair, Senator Anderson, the Chemolite site is located immediately adjacent to the Mississippi River. So certainly any releases that have emanated from that site into the sediments, into the water in the Mississippi River, that would be covered here.
Mr. Chair, okay, so the whole, any contamination anywhere in the Mississippi River, I mean, how do you define that boundary? How far downstream does that site-related remediation obligation go? Do we know? Fish, drinking water? I mean, people. Some people get the drinking water from the Mississippi.
Mr. Rodes.
Mr. Chair, Senators, the... I'll just try to separate the remediation piece to the natural resource damage piece, because I think that's part of what your question is getting after. With regard to the cleanup of the Cottage Grove Chemolite site, there are at least a couple of different things as it relates to the river. One is there's the cove, and I don't know if you've had an opportunity to see it, but there is a cove that is that's just right on the site that contains quite a bit of contaminated sediment. That's a part of the site. The way we generally deal with remediation, and it's called for in the exhibits to this consent order, is that within a one-mile radius, any surface water within a one-mile radius of a site is considered to be part of a site. That entails quite a bit of the Mississippi River. What the company is required to do, and they're currently doing, is to do investigations of surface water levels as well as sediment levels. Downstream, I think they've gone as far as, I believe, Hastings. I could be wrong on that, but it's gone quite a far, quite a way down. The contamination, my understanding, is drops off in terms of the sediment pretty rapidly after the site. So as far as remediation is concerned, the sediments, you know, dealing with ongoing releases, threat to human health, the environment, those would be considered part of the site remediation. If there's additional work related to contamination from the site that we think is reasonable and necessary to deal with through this consent order, then you know, we'd have discussions with 3M about that. But I think as far as the most important pieces, which are the cove and the contamination right by the site that we know about, you know, that's covered from my perspective. On the natural resource damage claim side of things, is to the extent that we feel that there has been damage to the resource, whether it's the fishery, whether it's the water, and that there's a claim that we can pursue, we do have the ability to do that.
What chapter is a natural resource damage claim? Is it any of these? Well, it says, or other state law. So you're saying, aren't you saying that you have agreed not to bring such an action under that law?
Mr. Chair, I'll have Alan Williams respond to that, but it's actually the opposite.
Mr. Chair, Alan Williams, the consent order expressly reserves the agency's authority to sue for natural resource damages. It would be on page 40 at the top of the page. Okay. It's the end of clause or paragraph D in part 25.
Well, Mr. Williams, maybe you could just mention then what would you not be able to sue for or take legal or administrative or equitable action for that you have available that you would not now have available under the clause not to sue. What are some examples?
Well, Mr. Chair, the covenant not to sue essentially says that the agency will not use its legal authorities to take action against 3M with respect to the three sites and the remediation of the three sites as long as they're in compliance with this agreement.
Are going to bring a bill up again today?
Okay.
I don't know.
That's what that means.
They've recessed.
Okay. And that includes the natural resources damage claim?
No, Mr. Chair. The natural resource damages claim is outside of the covenant not to sue.
Okay. And then the next question is
Mr. Chair, if I could clarify, the covenant not to sue deals only with response actions and response costs at the three sites. That's all. So not natural resource damages or claims that wouldn't be covered under that language.
So then the groundwater pumping that you were referring to earlier, is that at where it should be now, or could we have required more under this agreement?
Mr. Chair, members, I think that from our perspective, that issue is being treated adequately for a couple of different reasons. One is we've made it clear that we have the ability to do all the cost recovery necessary to address the water quality discharge issues. So as far as the pump out of the and treatment of the groundwater, they are required to comply with current permits. We are in the process of developing a water quality standard, which I believe is going to be done here in the coming months, which will require emission limits in their MPDS, their water quality permit, to manage the discharge of that pump out. So we do feel it's being treated adequately.
I thought I understood that it was difficult, if not impossible, to remove PFCs from the water. What do you do when you pump this out, and where does the water go?
Mr. Chair, members, there are at least a couple of different technologies that I've heard of. I'm not a water quality wastewater engineer, so it's a little bit beyond my area of expertise, but there's carbon filtration. There are also some other technologies with resins that I'm minimally aware of that could work. But I think from our perspective is once we have a water quality standard that's going to be in the permit, they will be expected to comply with it, and we have every expectation that they will be able to.
Further questions from the members? Senator Sieben.
About that 1 mile, Mr. Chair and Mr. Rodiz, about the 1 mile plume or the 1 mile radius that you said is cited in the agreement or in the attachments, I would assume. Is that standard, or how do you come up with 1 mile versus looking at the contamination 5 miles downstream or something else? was that a negotiated part of the settlement, I guess, would be another question.
Mr. Chair,
Mr. Rodiz.
Members, it's a fairly standard aspect of this type of an agreement. There is a technical term which escapes me at the moment, but it's a unit of something or other that the remediation staff use, and it's an iterative process. So, you know, they start with this. It's the 1 mile radius. That's a fairly good way of managing this issue. If it turns out in the investigation that the scope of the contamination that needs to be remediated is greater than that, we don't expect that's going to be the case. But if it does turn out to be the case, this agreement doesn't preclude us from doing what's necessary to clean that up.
And Mr. Chair, does the remediation in any way attempt to lower the exposure to the fish so that eventually is the idea for how you determine when the sediment is clean or when, or at least is feasible to, as clean as it, you can get it? Does that have anything to do with whether or not there's still a fish consumption on that portion of the river?
Mr. Rodiz.
Madam Chair, Senator, we'd probably have to talk to our scientists to give you a specific answer to that question as it relates to fish consumption. What I can tell you is that what this agreement really is all about is it's about removing as much of this material from the environment as is possible so that we ensure that there isn't continued ongoing contamination that's going to affect both human health and the environment, including fish. As far as how that relates to fish consumption advisories and how soon we might see an effect in the environment, decreases in fish tissue concentration, you know, I think that's something I really can comment on. But we expect that there will be some change in the environment, a positive change as a result of that. How that's going to play itself out over what period of time, I think, it's beyond me.
Follow up?
Mr. Chair, I have some concerns or some questions over portions of the agreement that seem to limit the public's ability to know what is going on in terms of remediation or cleanup. So first, in general, could you comment on the states? I want some reassurance from you, Mr. Rodiz, or your understanding that for the remediation of the drinking water or the surface water, and the plans that the PCA is going to undertake to implement the remediation, that information is available and open to the public for review.
Mr. Rodiz.
Mr. Chair, Senators, that gets back to one of the first points I made at the beginning of the hearing, which is that the agency has a very strong commitment to being
very, very open and transparent throughout this process, and that's been an objective of ours going back for some time. And it's one of the reasons why I appreciate that we had an opportunity to come and talk with you about this agreement today. It's conversations like this we think are very, very positive and good to helping the committee understand what's going on. On the remediation side of things, the agreement specifically calls for the agency to hold public meetings to discuss the remediation actions that will be undertaken to basically implement this agreement. That's very clear in the agreement. As far as a commitment to make sure that the community is continually involved and gets the information they need on issues related to drinking water and other issues related to PFCs, yes, I can make that commitment on behalf of the agency that we will continue to do that.
Does the consent order in any way provide additional limitations on public input and availability of information?
Mr. Chair, members, it does not.
Thank you. Do you have anything further, Senator Sieben?
Well, Mr. Chair and Mr. Odiz, I'm just some of the language in here about the confidential information, I certainly, not being an attorney, I guess, can begin to understand, but it would seem to me that it seems as though in some sections, and perhaps counsel could help me on this, it seems as though some of the documents that 3M is required to, under this agreement, to now share with the MPCA at a later date can be destroyed after a certain time period. And I'm kind of just wondering about that and what kind of what that relates to. And
Ms. Baker.
Mr. Chair, I can just elaborate on some of the concerns some of the senators saw. If on page 26 in paragraph B, I thought the last sentence of that the agency agrees to classify any documents provided by 3M, and this obviously would not include the attorney-client privileged ones, which, you know, have a pretty strong privilege as non-public data. And the question immediately came up is, why would everything in here be automatically covered blanket-wise as a non-public data when it seems like they don't have – it's not manufactured anymore, right? There's no profit line coming from this, so it's not really – connected to a proprietary secret or trade secret, is it? But and we just want an explanation of that. And as long as and connected to that is the retention of records period only being 3 years. And I can't see, that's page 30. That 3M can notify MPCA. 90 days before destroying any documents. They only have to preserve them for 3 years. That was another concern that some of the senators had, that seemed like a really short period of time. And we're just wondering how that was agreed upon and what were the factors that led to making that agreement.
Mr. Chair, members, I'll take those in reverse order. On the latter question, that's really standard boilerplate language for a MRLA consent order, so it's no different than what we've done in the past. I would say that given the expected length of the implementation of this agreement, which will be decades, that this is an issue that's not going to be faced for quite some time. And again, it's a standard provision in a MRLA consent order. With regard to the first question, and I'll have Alan talk about that in more detail, but we did have a discussion about the fact that we are governed by the Data Practices Act, and it's certainly not our intention to do anything that deviates from that, and I'll just ask Alan to maybe talk about that for a bit.
Mr. Williams.
Mr. Chair, Alan Williams. Just to elaborate slightly on what Leo said, in the retention of records, the 3 years doesn't run until the termination of the agreement. So since the agreement is expected to be in place for a very long time, the retention of records will also last for a very long time. As far as the classification of data, the provision on page 26 is simply a cross-reference to Part 22 of the order, which is the general language on how information could be handled as confidential. It's not an automatic. If you look at Part 22 on page 35, it indicates that 3M may request, in accordance with the procedural rules of the agency, non-public treatment of information, and then it cites statutes under which that classification could happen. And, of course, the basic statute is the Data Practices Act. This order does not, and I don't think could go any could go beyond the Data Practices Act in terms of what the MPCA could hold confidential. So this is going to require 3M to make their case. In fact, the procedural rules say that a party seeking confidentiality has to not only show the specific statute under which they're entitled to confidential treatment, but explain why that particular information meets that statutory requirement. So,
is it automatic as long as they state a reason?
Mr. Chair, under the PCA rules, I believe that until the PCA makes the determination in a situation like that, that they would hold the information confidential.
Thank you. Senator Saltzman.
Yes. I'd just like to thank you, Mr. Chair, for this opportunity to have this presented to this committee, and especially this committee, because I know how all of you are very committed to the public health and the environment. And I'm also very glad that you've asked some very, very tough questions. You have before you also, I hope, a couple letters that represent the mayors of the communities that I represent, and one of them is from Cottage Grove, which is in our Stevens district. The goal of our mayors, I believe, is that they want to ensure the safety of the drinking water. They want these contaminants to be contained or else removed, and are very pleased, although we are not pleased that we have this situation before us, but very pleased that the MPCA has negotiated this agreement that really does go above and beyond what could have been expected had we perhaps gone a different route. So I just want to thank this committee again for having this presentation today. Even though we just have a few days left, this is a very timely issue. But in terms of the people in my community, they want this taken care of in a very expedient manner. And I think they've addressed those comments, especially a letter from the Lake Elmo mayor. Lake Elmo has dealt with this for a longer period of time. And specifically in this letter from Dean Johnston, he says that the 3M approach could be considered a role model for a company dealing with any environment issue. And they are, again, not pleased that they have this issue, but feel that the 3M company represents not a business that came into our community, dumped something, and left. They are part of our community, and I believe that they have tried to, in very good faith, come to the table and really try to address this and really begin to address the problems that we will have for a very long time. And as long as they're willing to come to the table, I think we should continue to really negotiate with them. When they fail to do that, I think you throw everything at them. So at this point, I just want to make sure that you're aware of what our mayors have done and how they've expressed their support for this agreement at this point in time. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Vickery.
As kind of an outsider trying to figure out what's going on here, great faith in the PCA.
I do. Good
people there. When I look at this little line on the side, the negotiated agreement meets and exceeds all of the needs expressed by the MPCA board, we ought to follow that. You're doing a lot more than even S3M would have to do according to law, the way I read this. I might be wrong. But, you know, we can't be too hard on big companies because Minnesota's going to start coming down. I think this 3M is a step forward. And I'm saying that from somebody that doesn't even have a 3M. I guess there is maybe one in Redwood. But I think they've went more than they would have had to. Now, you might disagree with me, you people living here, but I think they've been a little backwards. That's only the statement I'm going to make. I think as long as it exceeds more than what the board asked them to do, the board has to control this whole state. We can't be in every corner of Minnesota, but the board is. Same thing they do with feedlots and everything else. If we meet what we're supposed to do, that should be okay. And I think that's, well, I read this, that the, what 3M has done.
Well, Senator Vickerman, a wise man once said, trust but verify. And I think it is the due diligence and the responsibility of this committee to trust the work of the PCA, which I think they've done yeoman's work in this. But we as representatives of the people who hold the election certificates and ultimately have to answer back to the people who are affected by this issue need to examine this agreement very carefully and to make sure that when we go back, particularly Senators Saltzman and Sieben, when they go back to the people they represent and they are asked, what of my water, they will be able to answer with accuracy.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Sieben?
If I could just add and respond to Senator Vickerman. You know, Senator Vickerman, I appreciate your comments, and I certainly appreciate Senator Saltzman coming here and presenting these letters. And I know that I have at times been a thorn in 3M's side, and I'm sure they would agree with that pretty easily. I want to be able to assure not only my mayors, but also the people who have contacted me, who have said they don't want their infants to be having their bottle formulas made with contaminated water, that they don't want to grow up on private wells where levels of a contaminant that we just discovered, that the PCA just discovered this past year, that we as state lawmakers are not doing everything we can to ensure that people have access to clean water. And we've spent so much time in this committee talking about the importance of clean water. And in many regards, 3M has been very responsible in ensuring that they do the responsible thing to clean up these water supplies. They've also fought me on a lot of my proposals that I've had, and it's been very frustrating at times. But in the end, I can hold my head high by going back to my constituents and saying that I'm sticking up for what I think is in their best interest, and that is that they're not unnecessarily exposed to a contaminant that the PCA at an earlier date, as early as last month, declared in their actions to recommend a RFRA that these substances are hazardous. And so I get really frustrated with the company when they repeatedly go to my to local elected officials or hold private meetings in the community with leaders and say, you know, Senator Sieben is blowing this up and making this a bigger deal and devaluing people's homes in our area because she's making a big deal out of this. I'm not making a big deal out of this. I didn't put those contaminants in the water. I'm trying to make sure that the company takes responsibility and removes them so that there is no question that people are not exposed to substances that there's no need for them to be exposed to. The great thing is we have the technology, it looks like, to remove these. So that's my ultimate goal here, and that's been my goal this session. And I certainly appreciate Chair Chaudhry's willingness to hold this hearing to answer some of these questions that I had, and also to work with me and others, Senator Anderson in particular, to advance, I think, really good legislation this year to help protect the citizens. So to not only deal with the cleanup, but also help look at the long-term implications of exposure to PFCs. And, you know, it may seem that Minnesota is doing more, but, you know, they're the company that produced it in Cottage Grove in my district. And unfortunately, now Minnesota has to deal with some of the highest exposures of PFCs in the world. So this isn't an issue that's going to go away. Certainly this consent order will help expedite the process of cleaning it up. But I'd like to say that it would be done after this session. You won't have to hear about it anymore, but I'm certain that in the future there will be other legislation that is needed and other steps that the state can take to ensure the safety of the people of the state.
Senator Stevens, I'm not doubting it needs to clean up. I'm just saying when this letter here that I'm looking at, they're doing more than they were supposed to do according to the PCA. Somebody has to set the rules here. I can't.
No, and
that's my only concern.
Senator Vickerman, I appreciate that, and I guess I didn't mean to take any frustration that I have out on you for saying that. I know that the company has fought me, though, on some of, pretty much every piece of legislation I've introduced on this matter, which is certainly their right to do so. And I think in some cases we've worked together and come up with conclusions that are more acceptable to both me and the company. But overall, I think the bottom line is we as lawmakers need to answer to our constituents and help explain to them that I can tell people that I've done what I think is best in this situation.
Did somebody actually say that raising this issue is devaluing properties?
Mr. Chair, I don't think we need to get into the specifics, at least on the public record, but I'd be happy to share some conversations that people have passed on to me that have been said by representatives of the company.
Senator Saltzman.
To her point, I guess, Mr. Chair, I think there is a concern by residents of my community that are in this area that they don't want to hear the word Woodbury and hear contaminated water, and that's why we are very committed to the cleanup. Some of the legislation that I have sponsored is to deal with what kind of water filters take these contaminants out. How long do they work? That's one of the big questions. And so one of those studies that will be done is to figure that out. And I think that this particular proposal begins to deal with that in a very proactive way. So I don't think that it's an issue of anyone finding fault, although people are talking about that, is how do we address the issue? Because we want to make sure that we have beautiful communities. The St. Croix River Valley is a gorgeous area. You're all welcome to come and visit. And I hope that when you come, you will not be concerned about drinking our water because we're going to clean it up. We're going to find out what the health-based values are or the health risk levels or whatever we need to do to be able to ensure that the drinking water in our community is safe, that this is cleaned up, and that people continue to see our communities as wonderful places to raise their families and to do business. And that's, I think, my goal and what I want to have accomplished through either legislation or through the action that is taking place through this agreement if it's approved on Tuesday. So, and I thank Senator Sieben for really taking leadership in that, you know, we found out about this in January. It really has been an issue that has been with both of us and other legislators throughout the past 4 months. And I feel very good that this agreement really came together in the course of 10 days because people said, we're really going to come together. We're going to work on this. We're going to find what we need to do at this point in time, and clearly leaves the door open in case there are other issues that, you know, come up in the future. You've asked some really, really good questions about that, and it was great to have them on tape and on record.
Senator Saltzman, do you know whether Cottage Grove, Woodbury, or Lake Elmo had a similar hearing or discussion about the consent order?
I believe, maybe to ask Mr. Rejoice, did you meet with the mayor of Lake Elmo? He was having a meeting. I know that he was briefed by this. He had a briefing. I know that the city of Woodbury has been looking at the agreement. They've not been able to have a hearing of this nature in the last 10 days, but they have looked at, I think that in the letter it talks about what they wanted to have accomplished. And in looking at the agreement, and I cannot speak because the mayors could not be here today, I asked them to come so they could ask, you know, sort of answer those kinds of questions. So I believe that the Lake Elmo mayor was meeting with somebody to go over this agreement in more depth earlier this week, but I don't know who that is.
Mr. Rodiz, were there any public presentations of this consent order in Woodbury, Cottage Grove, or Lake Elmo? And if not, are there any planned?
Mr. Chair, not to my knowledge, at least not from the agency. Our plan is to do that at the board meeting scheduled day. We have all the folks we've just talked about on our mailing list, so they're all aware of the consent order. It's on our website. We did receive a letter, I believe, from the mayor of Newport, if I'm not mistaken, just within the last couple of days. So I think the word is out there in the community. They've seen the draft consent order. And they, as well as anybody in this room, are welcome to come to the board meeting on Tuesday to hear the discussion.
I don't know. I'm a lawyer. I chair the Senate's Environment Committee. And I needed to have a lot of questions answered. So, and I've only had a chance to review this over a week or so. We had one citizens board member for the PCA said she has not had a chance to see it. So I don't know how people are drawing such conclusions so easily. I feel better after today's hearing. But that's because we had an open and thorough discussion. And from my point of view, I think a lot of these things have been verified by the testimony, and I appreciate the Attorney General's assistance in this. But I'm still going to wait and see how it fleshes out. I compliment the PCA on its work, but I'm still going to wait and see how this fleshes out. So I don't know how Woodbury, Cottage Grove, and Lake Elmo drew such a conclusion so quickly, and this is 2 days ago.
Mr. Chair, I know that at least for Cottage Grove and Newport, they were briefed by 3M on the agreement.
Okay. Well, that's good. Mm-hmm. That's good, and we're going to be briefed by them as well. Are there any further questions for Mr. Rodiz? Thank you so much, and we appreciate your hard work. Catherine Reed. Welcome to the committee, and thank you for your patience.
Well, thank you very much. Good afternoon. I think it is afternoon, mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Dr. Catherine Reed, and I'm the Staff Vice President for Environmental Health and Safety Operations at 3M. I'm here today to express 3M's support for and to answer your questions about the settlement agreement and consent order negotiated with the MPCA staff covering our ongoing efforts and our proposed future plans for the 3M Cottage Grove site, the Oakdale disposal site, and the Woodbury disposal site. The agreement provides a legally enforceable framework for getting the work done at the three sites in an expeditious manner. The agreement spells out clearly what 3M's obligations are and provides for rigorous oversight for the process by the MPCA. The detailed nature of the agreement affords certainty for the state, for the community residents, and for 3M that the job will get done, irrespective of changes in leadership at the MPCA or 3M. The agreement provides for extensive remedial measures at each of the three sites, in addition to defraying a portion of the remediation costs at the Washington County landfill, which was not part of the original RFRA request from the board. The agreement also provides for the payment of the state's costs associated with the three sites, as well as investigation costs of other sites associated with 3M facilities in Minnesota. Additional costs incurred by the MPCA for investigation and monitoring at locations not associated with 3M operations are also covered by the commitment to pay for these costs over the next 4 years. This commitment goes beyond what the original RFRA for the sites could require. The agreement provides 3M's commitment to cooperate on future research, to provide information to the MPCA, and to provide for alternative drinking water to meet science-based HBV or HRL limits. And the community will continue to have an important role since the agreement provides for community review of the remediation plan for each of the sites before the work begins. As I just mentioned, the agreement provides for commitments by 3M that go well beyond what the law requires and beyond what the RFRAs would have required. We believe this agreement meets the expectations of the public as expressed by the MPCA Citizens Board and provides a framework for proceeding immediately with technical solutions to these issues. We began work to address PFCs 3 years ago under the direction of the MPCA and reimburse the state for its oversight costs. We are ready to proceed under the settlement agreement and consent order to continue the work already begun. We believe it is an appropriate and effective approach to remediating these sites. I thank you for your interest in this matter, and I'd be glad to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you very much, Ms. Reed. I just had a couple questions.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Mr. Chair. Ms. Reed, I want to apologize to you because members are not here. It isn't right. This young lady has sat here for an hour and a half. And who is here? This farm boy in Jodre. So just accept my apology. I'll apologize to them. Maybe they got other things to work, but it doesn't look good. This is a very, very important issue that we're studying here today. Mm-hmm. They may have reasons, but I'm going to stay here if we stay here for 3 days, as long as you want to sit down there and tell us what's going on, because I like the company. I think we need to work together, and I'm going to go back what I said. I think you have leaned over backwards, in my opinion. Maybe not for some of the water problems that Senator Chaudhry that we need to kind of work through, but the main part of this, the cleanup of that part, I think is in good here. I really do.
Well, it is a good company. We use your product every day.
I'm so glad.
Questions, Ms. Reed, I think PCA answered a lot of them. I think one of the preeminent issue that you must have gathered, Ms. Reed, is on the jurisdiction of PCA in the state regarding MRLA. Do you agree that, does 3M agree that the PCA retains jurisdiction under MRLA?
Mr. Chair and Senators, I'm not a lawyer. From my position in the company as the person responsible for our remediation efforts, we respect the jurisdiction and agree that MPCA has jurisdiction over this agreement and everything in it in whatever context the MPCA has already disclosed to you.
So you would agree with PCA's representations today?
Yes.
Thank you. And then, similarly on the covenant not to sue, do you agree with, not being a lawyer, do you agree with PCA's representations on what the covenant not to sue means?
Within my understanding as a non-lawyer person, yes, I agree.
Thank you. What do you understand in this commitment is 3M's obligation to public health and particularly biomonitoring of public health issues? And then what do you see as 3M's role outside of this agreement?
Mr. Chair and Senators, the biomonitoring issue, I think, is a separate one. However, as part of this agreement, there is a provision for risk assessment. And to that extent, exposures of the public and wildlife and waters of the state will be evaluated with respect to releases or potential releases from these sites. So it is covered in great specificity with respect to risk assessment.
Okay, very good. Senator Sieben, any follow-up for Ms. Reed?
Well, no, I'm sorry. I just jumped out of the room. I don't have any questions.
One thing I want to mention, Ms. Reed, is that we've had some technology advances in the Senate. And when we tape our hearings, they are almost instantly available digitally online for the members to hear, and that is that's something that we can very easily go back to, and members often do go back to and listen to the proceedings. So just because someone's here, we would of course like more people to be here, but just because they're not doesn't mean they won't hear the testimony. Further questions from the members? Want to thank the parties for being here today and for briefing the legislature on this very important issue. There were a lot of twists and turns to this issue in recent months. There were a lot of intense negotiations between the state and 3M, and being that the agreement was consent order agreement was reached last week. In all fairness, there was very little time for at least the committee that's going to be in session only until Monday to thoroughly consider the agreement and to seek legal advice, particularly from counsel. I would have to say that I think we have had a significant vetting of this agreement, and although we don't vote on this issue, I think that a lot of the things that were explained to us were helpful during this discussion, and we hope that the Citizens Board has an equally robust discussion. As I mentioned, we will continue to monitor this issue, we will be the members of the committee will be looking upon what results from this agreement with great interest, particularly over the interim. Whether it be an interim hearing or a hearing next session, we'll still be here and we will remain interested in the issue. Thank you, and thank you in particular, Senator Bickerman, for being here the entire time and for your attention. So if there isn't any other discussion, the committee will be adjourned.